Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Wednesday 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host, and I'm proud to be part of the coolest team on the radio. Each week, Hank, Greg, Mary, Tatiana, Nicole Rochelin, and I celebrate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys and then return us safely home. The stories we share not only entertain, but also they help us understand who we are, what we believe, and what values we hold dear. 10 years ago, So What's Your Story was just a gleam in Hank's eye. Then he got a phone call from KPFT to be a guest on someone else's show, which led to an offer to host a once-a-month show. You listened, you donated, and before long the show was on once a week. You kept listening, you kept donating, and the show kept expanding from 30 minutes to an hour, and from late night on Thursday to prime time Wednesday. And he'll tell you more about that later. And here we are once again in our summer fun drive, and we're asking for your support. That's the only way we can keep bringing these riveting stories to you. And I have a modest proposal. If you'll call us at 713-526-5738 and make a donation, or if you'll go online and donate at www.kpft.org, and if you do that, be sure to indicate that you're designating us as the show you're donating to. If you'll do this, then we'll get on to the real business of our show, which is stories, not sales pitches. One of our steadfast volunteers will take your call, and later in the show, we'll check in and let you know how we're doing. Now, tonight, we've got two amazing storytellers. The type that our program spotlights each week, and the sort of community talent you pay for on Pacifica Radio. Both are writers. They write short stories, they write narrative nonfiction. And both are also physicians who work at Bentob Hospital and serve on the faculty of Baylor College of Medicine. They also belong to a new storytelling group called Off Script, which formed last year among employees of the Texas Medical Center. Surprised? Don't be. Medicine and storytelling are richly connected. And my guests, Drs. Michelle Schmidt and Ricardo Nuila, will show that through the stories that they tell tonight. Michelle, Ricardo, welcome to So What's Your Story.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
We're delighted you're here. Now, Michelle, you came to Baylor College of Medicine in 1991, and I think you've been there ever since. You came first as a medical student, then as an internal medicine resident, then an adolescent medicine fellow, and now you're a member of the faculty. Michelle works in the adolescent medicine clinic along with, I think, the internal medicine service and the emergency room of Bentob. And not only do you work with adolescents during the day at the hospital, you have three of your own at home. You're a mother to three teenagers. And as you've told me, you are a wife to your best friend. You've also told me that you just happen to be a breast cancer survivor, which means you've experienced illness from both sides of the treatment equation. In addition to all of this, you're also a writer and an artist. You identify yourself as a writer and an artist. As busy as you are with other parts of your life, tell us why you have and take the time and energy for writing and telling stories.
I think it's important to be creative every day, whether it's cooking a really good meal or doing a collage with unusual art pieces. It's just a way to relieve stress, and it uses a different side of the brain than what you use when you're at work.
And I'm guessing in your work you do deal with a lot of stress, so there's a need to process that stress.
I don't think you feel the stress when you're there, but yeah, it's a way to unwind.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And tonight our listeners are going to be the beneficiaries of that unwinding. I'm looking forward to your first story. What's it called?
My first story is called Slam Dunk.
Slam Dunk. So it's a basketball story.
not a basketball story, but I guess a basketball analogy.
Yeah. Is there anything our listeners need to know by way of background before you start the story?
Just if there's kids listening, there's some sensitive material, so they yeah. might want to be mindful of that. But otherwise, no, it's just a typical day in the emergency room.
I'm looking forward to your story.
So, I work in a busy emergency room, and like everyone else who works there, I feel the pressure to see patients quickly and efficiently, without compromising the quality of the care. The line of patients waiting to be seen can seem never-ending, and the quicker I can assess and disposition my patients, the faster I can clear a busy waiting room. At times, it seems like I'm trying to accomplish two completely different objectives: clear the board of patients, and also effectively engage a population of patients who use the emergency room as their safety net. It's a double-edged sword. If I listen to a single patient too long, then I don't get to see enough patients. But if I don't listen to their story long enough, I'll miss pertinent details. One Saturday morning, I went to see my first patient, and I felt lucky because I had access to a computer on wheels. We also call those cows. This makes documentation in the electronic medical record much more efficient. Before I went in to see my patient, I reviewed her information in the electronic medical record. The triage note said that she was in her first trimester of pregnancy and she had come in for a sore throat. The patient had stable vital signs, no fever, her pulse and blood pressure were normal, and she had a normal oxygen level. And during her 16-hour wait to be seen, she had some tests done. By the time she came back to the treatment area, I knew that all of her labs were normal, her strep test was negative, and she had an ultrasound confirming a first trimester pregnancy. All I had to do was go in and talk to her briefly so I could document the encounter, and I could move on to the next patient. This should have been a slam dunk. After talking to her for about 10 minutes, the encounter proved to be a greater challenge than I had anticipated. I walked into her room, and I smiled and introduced myself, to which she responded, "I don't speak English." She spoke just enough English to tell me this. She was from another country and spoke another language. Fortunately, our hospital has a phone interpretation service, but obtaining a history via an interpreter not only lengthens the patient encounter, but it also makes you completely dependent on the reliability of the interpreter for the patient's responses. In my mind, my slam dunk was already taking longer than I had anticipated. Once the interpreter came on the phone, he introduced himself as Mr. 10,422. He and I went through the routine questions that you ask a patient. We asked about her history, and I did a physical exam. We talked about her chief complaint, her details of her present symptoms. We talked about her past medical and surgical history and inquired about drug allergies, substance use, and finally I asked her if she was taking any medications. Her responses via the interpreter to all of my questions had been quick and concise, and I had renewed hope that I'd soon be able to move on to my next patient. When asked about her medications, she and Mr. 10,422 talked in their language longer than all the other questions combined. Trying my best not to seem rushed, I waited for them to finish their conversation. I still had two new patients to see, and several more had been placed in rooms since our interview began. At last, Mr. 10,422 relayed her medications to me. Per his report, she had not taken any medications, including prenatal vitamins, since she had been raped. He spoke with an accent, but I knew I had heard that last part of the statement correctly. "Excuse me, you said after she was raped?" I sputtered. "Yes, ma'am. She said she was raped." "Wait a minute. When was she raped? This is a new part of the story." Suddenly, the tone of the encounter had changed, and my agenda of being efficient had just been curbed. I had to be fully present in that exam room with this young woman for as long as it would take. I got her paper towels to blow her nose and wipe away her tears. I stopped typing, sat down next to the bed, looked her in the eye, and listened to her story. She was a recent immigrant to our country, and during her journey to the United States, about 2 months before she arrived, she had been raped, and she never saw her assailants again. Since arriving in the United States, she had not discussed the circumstances of her pregnancy with anyone. As it turns out, she came to the ER that day not only for a sore throat, but to talk about the shame of being raped, her ambivalence towards her pregnancy, and her future options. I had walked into her exam room that morning with my own agenda, my own assumptions, and my own preconceived ideas. I had assumed I'd be delivering good news when I told her she didn't have strep throat and the ultrasound showed a healthy 6-week-old baby with a strong heartbeat, and she wasn't even sure she wanted to keep the pregnancy. Our conversation must have taken over an hour while we traded information back and forth via Mr. 10422, a nameless, faceless, yet utterly professional and discreet interpreter. He and I were bound together listening to the most intimate details of this young woman's story. Yet he had no idea what I thought, and I had no idea what he thought. Would her story affect him for the rest of the day and the rest of the week the way it had affected me? He knew things I didn't know and couldn't ask, like how gender, religion, and cultural norms impacted her decision to seek or delay medical care, and how much and what kind of stigma might be involved with her rape, her undesired pregnancy, and her consideration of terminating the pregnancy. Together, he and I acknowledged her trauma, expressed sorrow for what she had experienced, validated her ambivalence of a pregnancy born out of violence and hatred, understood her desire to potentially terminate this pregnancy, and listened to her symptoms. The three of us, the patient, Mr. 10422, and I, encountered a level of intimacy that few individuals ever experience. She agreed to speak to a social worker, someone who would give her information about community resources and counseling for rape survivors in locations that would provide pregnancy termination. She and I hugged at the end of her visit, and the embrace lasted longer than usual. I could tell she was appreciative that someone had listened to her story completely and without rushing on to the next person. I suspect she also expressed appreciation to Mr. 10422 at the end of our phone call. Even now, our encounter pervades my thoughts, wondering what life must be like for her. She risked everything she had, her life, her dignity, her safety, to come to this country in the hope of a better life. Every day I hear dozens of stories, and all I need to do is stop and listen. None of the people I treat or the stories they tell are a slam dunk. This young woman and the kindness of Mr. 10422 remind me why I decided to practice medicine in the first place, not for the numbers or the pace or the adrenaline, but for the people.
Wow. I'm guessing your work in the emergency room involves lots of surprises.
Every day and every encounter is something new and different, yes.
Is this patient any more of a surprise than a lot of others?
Not really, because you never know what's going to be behind the door, and you just have to remind yourself and check yourself before you go in to be willing to stop and listen and to not rush through the encounter.
Right. And you described a level of intimacy that few people ever experience, and yet you were with one stranger and not even with the other stranger.
Correct. And with the interpretation services, you don't know. It's a nameless, faceless person. Could be anywhere in the world.
And you never met that person, I guess, or?
No.
Wow. But through her story, you all became very intimate.
Correct. Wow. And then as soon as it starts, it finishes just like that.
And I think you said twice that you listened to her story, and I'm not sure everybody thinks of a physician's job as that anymore.
I think that's exactly what our job is, particularly as internists, both Ricardo and I. Our main job is to be able to listen to stories and then to relay that story to other physicians and other care providers.
What would you like our listeners to take from your story?
Just that not everything is as it seems.
Yeah.
Take time to unwrap and to really see who it is that you're talking to and what their story is.
Well, I applaud you for doing that. And as all of us listening are patients, and we've had experiences that were different from that, where we haven't felt our caregivers heard our story. And so it makes a huge difference. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story here on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You can catch us at 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and online at www.kpft.org. And a reminder, we're in the middle of the summer fun drive. Please, please call us, 713-526-5738. In fact, if you call right now, you can get that donation done and not even miss the next story. No donation is too large or too small, and we mean that. 713-526-KPFT. We'll check in with Pledge Central at the bottom of the hour, but first I'd like to bring in our second guest, Ricardo Nuila. As I mentioned earlier, Ricardo works with Michelle at Bentob Hospital and Baylor College of Medicine. He serves as director of Baylor's program in narrative medicine. His articles on health disparities have appeared in The New Yorker. In fact, two articles I read about Hurricane Harvey and health care during that period. His articles have appeared in The Atlantic and Texas Monthly. He just had one come out, I think, a couple of months ago in Texas Monthly.
That's right, yeah.
I read, and I didn't even know it was you. I feel so bad.
Well, that's actually the best thing that I could hear, that you just read it, and then
it was
wasn't
great.
A favor to me. You just read it.
Yes,
I love that.
Yes. New York Times Sunday Review and New England Journal of Medicine. Ricardo's fiction has been featured in all sorts of places, and his first book, which tells the stories of patients in America's public hospitals, will be published by Scribner in 2020. All of this is amazing, but I think the most amazing thing is what happened 7 days ago. You became a father of Teo Santiago.
Yes.
Nuila. 8 pounds, 7 ounces, 22 inches.
Very un-Nuila-like. Long, big. You know, it's amazing. It couldn't have gone better. I wrote that article about maternal mortality, and I had the best.
That was Texas Monthly.
My wife had the best experience, so we felt so fortunate.
Yes.
And it was just a wonder to see childbirth. It's just a wonder. So
congratulations to you and all the family, and you'll have some more to write about, thanks to Teo, I'm sure.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah.
Now, the birth of a baby is both a blessing and a miracle, but tonight I need to warn our readers, you're going to be sharing stories from the other end of the life cycle.
Yeah.
Tell us about mort naturel.
Mort naturel. Well, so this is a work of fiction. This is a short story written in three parts. I'm going to be reading the first and the third part, and we have a conference in internal medicine called Morbidity and Mortality.
Mm-hmm. And M&M,
as it's informally called. But this is the imagination going with what happens in an M&M conference when the real stories behind the cases come out.
Well, I'm looking forward to your first story. What's it called?
All of the stories are one story called Mort Naturel, so I would just call this the first section.
Okay, right.
So,
and I'm guessing Mort Naturel is kind of ironic.
Yes. One of my mentors in one of these conferences opened up by saying that. He had heard that somebody wrote that on the death certificate of somebody actually somebody who figures into this story. Mm-hmm. And so, in medical terms, it just indicates if you write natural death or mort naturel, then you haven't really thought of everything
right.
About what the cause of death really was.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll start. Mort naturel. There's the case of the skydiving instructor. A woman celebrating her son's 30th birthday jumps out of a plane harnessed to the skydiving instructor, Jim. Jim's 45 and a veteran of the original Persian Gulf War. The woman's a state employment counselor turned headhunter, age unlisted. For a brief moment, she enjoys the rush. She's not falling so much as gliding. I can't believe I'm doing this, she thinks. She counts 10 Mississippis, checks her gauge, pulls the cord. She expects a kick, a pop, whiplash, but there's nothing. She pulls again. Jim pulls. Nothing. The two fall at terminal velocity, 54 meters per second, 125 miles an hour. It's too loud to talk, but somehow Jim communicates with the woman. He tells her there's no need to panic, that things like this, chutes not opening, happen, which is why there's a failsafe, his parachute. It opens automatically at a certain height and speed. The best thing she can do, all she can do, is wait. And so she waits, and very soon, though not soon enough, she hears a boom. Red nylon ripples overhead, and immediately the world below disappears. Objects vibrate so violently they lose shape. A loud whooshing fills the air. What has happened is the emergency parachute has malfunctioned, sending the two into a barber's pole, a spiral toward the ground. Except the woman does not see the ground. She has lost orientation. She only knows she is falling. I know I'm going to die, she thinks. The people down below know something's wrong. Their accounts are all the same. There's anticipation, followed by consternation. What are they trying to do? Followed by horror. They don't believe this is happening, can't conceive something like this can occur, and yet it's so simple, a mass heading relentlessly toward the ground, physics. At the moment of impact, an impact people typically don't feel, the vast majority vasovagaling before hitting the ground, something overtakes the woman, a force that thrusts her legs above her head and pushes her neck forward such that the woman lands face up. The paramedics find her quiet and tangled in the parachutes. She has a pulse, follows commands, and moves all four limbs. This is all documented. The final diagnosis is an ipsilateral fracture of the right humerus and fibula, as well as some neck damage. The surgeons decide to fuse C3 through 7 so that now if she wants to look right or left, she has to turn her torso. That and a limp, the woman's told this will be temporary, are her only deficits. Jim's a different story. His spleen bursts upon impact. He breaks vertebrae at T7 through 11 and severs his spine. The left kidney is gone. Both adrenals infarct. His bowels perforate. You might think these are the findings at autopsy, but no, it's all in the op report, because Jim makes it to surgery. He hits the ground, and within 45 minutes, he's on the table for XLAP, which the surgeon quickly transforms into a total colectomy, followed by splenectomy, nephrectomy, laminectomy, etc. He develops recurrent abscesses. The surgeons take him to the OR for washouts every day, his bowel spillage hiding in the peritoneal folds like glass and carpet. Once the liver begins to fail, Jim's doctors fill out the necessary paperwork, and very quickly he moves to the top of the transplant list. Hospital administrators and department chiefs debate whether someone with so small a chance should be on such a list, but in the end, it doesn't matter. Jim dies. A postmortem performed 2 hours following reveals liquefactive brain necrosis in the pattern of a lawn with one working sprinkler. The pathologist on the case, overworked perhaps, the signs of burnout are there, questions outright in the chart why the physician of record would request an autopsy in the first place, even though it's clear from the detail of his findings, alli nuclei, porcelain gallbladder, honeycombed lung. He enjoys the sight of fresh versus refrigerated death. He lists heart failure as one of the causes, which brings to mind the fate of another Jim, James Douglas Morrison, lead singer of The Doors. Morrison's heart stopped in Paris and the French performed an autopsy, as they so often did. Can you tell me what's written on his death certificate? There's a nurse's note dated 2 days before our Jim's death. Often, nurses will paste printouts, computer-generated orders, flowcharts for documentation. Other notes, for instance, a layman's note, are not commonly used. What the nurse has done here is pasted a thank you note into the chart. It appears nice, professional, something one might send following a round of interviews. The signature appears illegible, but the words are clear. You saved my life. I will never forget. There are the phenomena of all such occurrences. If this person had come to this event at this time, maybe this never would have happened, etc. And maybe in the case of the skydiving instructor, these are legitimate afterthoughts, since the woman celebrating her son's 30th birthday really wasn't scheduled to jump that morning, and Jim really was supposed to be at his farm's father that day. You can go on. But that's not what's important here. What's important is this. At the very moment of impact, Jim pulled the woman above him, curled her from the heap of harnesses and half-deployed parachutes and jumpsuits, so that when the bodies hit, the woman fell on top of him. What matters is Jim took the fall, Jim, the skydiving instructor. By some ethic, this man sacrificed his body for that of a client, a stranger. I'm still trying to figure out why.
Ricardo, most of us go for weeks, months, years without having a brush with death. And I'm listening to your story and Michelle's, I realize this is what you do every day at your work.
Definitely dealing with death is a big part of the job. I think even talking about death is surprising. I didn't know that it would be that big of a, it's an important part of the job is to talk about death.
Yeah. And it's so redemptive that you found this heroic altruistic deed that this Jim did and that you've highlighted that as the culmination of the story. That's
I think in this story it's just sort of it's hard to fathom something like that. But there's acts of heroism everywhere.
Yeah. But you found it. You noticed it.
Well, I mean, this is a story, yeah. A fiction, but it's but in this particular story, certainly this was that had this. There's so many, there's so much tragedy, and you have to brush away all of the everything that obfuscates the heroism. Mm-hmm. But in this story, that was definitely the case that there was a hero there.
Yeah, could you share another story with us?
Sure. So this is going to be the third part of this. And I'll just start right now. The famous case of the intern who lost his head one evening. You may have received a forward about it, if you subscribe to those kinds of sites. It's this intern's first night call, and he's being paged to all the far corners of the hospital. Tylenol this, albuterol that. You remember the feeling. It's like you're floating. 2100 hours comes, and a patient on the 18th floor develops chest pain. The nurse pages whoever's on call, and the intern responds the way any intern at that stage of his career would, promptly and filled with fear. He orders an EKG, cardiac enzymes, new vitals, stat, tells the nurse over the phone he's en route, that all he has to do is reconcile some medications, which she documents. A half hour passes. The nurse pages him once, twice, a third time, no response. By this time, the chest pain has subsided. Patient sits quietly watching the food delivery personnel. One floor above, the rumors begin to circulate. Patients amass in their hospital grounds, outside their rooms. A line forms as if for a fire drill, though no alarm sounds. Word spreads quickly. The details are sparse. A woman announces on the overhead the hospital has closed all but the service elevators. She requests the guests take the stairs wherever they might go and await further instructions, though no such instructions arrive. There are those who must see for themselves, those who console strangers, those who debate the calculus of the matter, those who pray in circles. And then there's the intern, his body splayed out on the 16th floor, his head one floor above. He died of an accident, the shear from the elevator guillotining him, decapitation secondary to mechanical failure. But that's not what sticks with me in the case of the headless intern. What I can't get out of my head is the lady stuck with him inside the elevator that night. She's from Honduras, here working maintenance. Fake visa, fake fingernails, kindness in her heart. While a young intern's ordering an EKG via the phone, she's called to the rooftop after a helicopter rescue ends with bags of saline and an immeasurable number of sterile wraps floating about. She takes the service elevators up from the basement, one straight shot to the 16th floor, where the doors open, a young intern moves forward, and the next thing that happens, a head rolls in. 35 minutes she's alone with that head while the firemen try to pry open those doors, the bits of vertebrae and supraspinatus tendon and pulposus lodged in there like putty. Do you know that she migrated here to forget shit like this? Do you know she has worms in her brain? Not worms, but little larvae, cysts, cysticercosis, the most common cause of seizures south of us. It's the lack of potable water they have down there. That plus the brutality. She's seen her brother hacked with machetes. She's fed dogs sandwiches made with broken glass. All that violence pent up, all those stable cysts, and then a doctor's head rolls into her elevator. The firemen talk to her, at first in English, then through a translator. They tell her not to panic, cerrar los ojos, close your eyes. But she is moaning, and they are trying to concentrate, as is the engineering corps, as is the medical examiner, as are the doctors. One of the moonlighters, a guy who in 21 years of moonlighting hasn't seen, let alone touched a patient, this moonlighting gig being a loophole, an aberration, the biggest chunk of free money any MD's ever received, recalls how, when he was a med student, the sitters pacified the delirious with gospel hymns, and so he sings to her songs he hasn't heard since the first year of college, devotionals, songs about eagles, mountains, the Beatitudes. Could other songs have soothed her? What I need to know is it the harmony or the words? The elevator bucks and the head tilts. More blood pools. What hasn't clotted in the jugulars and the cavernous sinus slushes forward. The woman begins to seize, that is to say, one of those cyst ruptures. She's in status when he gets to her, a grandma with the tongue biting, the urinary incontinence, the leg thrashing, her first seizure ever. The firemen move like someone's lit a fire beneath their asses. The moonlighter, who for so long has felt himself vestigial, doesn't step out of the way but moves forward. He slides his head into the crack of the doors, then his shoulders, slithers his skinny torso inside the elevator like a serpent. He pulls Ativan from his front pocket, then Phenobarb, then the rock, administers each with wondrous deliberation, and our patient does well, comes out of the whole thing a little wet and bloody, arises from her stupor, takes one look at her surroundings, the streaks on the floor, the flashing buttons, the head of some young doctor, and says, "Gracias al Señor. Gracias."
Ricardo, your stories remind me that our lives are stories that are being rewritten and rewritten every day, and nobody knows how these stories are going to end, even us. We don't know how our own story is going to end.
That's the fun part about it. That's the, I mean, just we're, you know, it's going to change, you know, we're susceptible to change at all times, and that's good.
And lots of surprises, both in this, your story and Michelle's. Our mission is a radio program. This is where I have to do our pitch. I pivot and pitch is to provide a place where good stories like yours and Michelle's can be told. And as I said earlier in the show, we've been doing this for a long time. Hank's here, and I'm going to ask him to talk about where we've been as a show, where we'd like to go, and what we need to do to get there. Hank?
Thank you, Warren. Listen, before we start, I knew that Michelle and Ricardo would be great storytellers, but you need to know how fabulous the two of you are. Everything from vocal cadence to the use of words. You know, what many physicians don't realize is that learning to communicate well is a skill. And as Michelle pointed out, it really is the most important thing that you do. But, you know, I have found that being able to listen to what's meant rather than what's being said, and I think that both Ricardo and Michelle know what I'm talking about, is something stories could do. Does that make sense to you, too? Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Right? And that's why I'm so impressed by these stories. And Ricardo, you're a writer as well, and you know that it is so difficult to be able to express oneself in a way that makes sense to any audience. And I can't help but punctuate the point to our listeners, Warren, that this is exactly what we're paying for. We can listen to stories like these week in and week out, or listen to silence. Mm-hmm. It's a choice. 713-526-5738. We'll make sure we don't listen to silence, to make sure that we listen to stories like these. These are so magnificent. And, you know, sometimes we talk about Pacifica Radio almost in passing every week. Pacifica Radio, KPFT, is a Pacifica associate, began in part as part of the peace movement after World War II, when Lewis Hill, a D.C. newsman, was fired from a mainstream reporting job when he refused to misrepresent the facts. I could just kind of stop right there and let the world know how important that is, right? To be listener-sponsored was really unheard of then, because so many people doubted the viability of a broadcast model that didn't rely on corporate or government funding. And we've got it. That's what Pacifica is. And Pacifica was born in 1949 at KPFA in Berkeley. And Berkeley, Washington, D.C., New York City, and the one right here in Houston are the only four Pacifica stations left out of 14. We have to keep this kind of life alive. And this kind of story, the kind of stories that we're hearing tonight is exactly what you are paying for, folks. So please, please understand that you can't leave it to the next guy. It doesn't work that way. We need you to please call in. You know, the history of the show is interesting. I'm sorry it took so much time with that. I am. But when I was a guest in early 2008, I was talking about storytelling. That's why I was a guest on an open journal. And that week, our program manager, Ernesto Aguilar, called me and said, you know, the person who hosted you, well, she quit. And I thought, well, I hope it wasn't me. But she quit and asked me if I wanted to host this open journal, which was once a month. And I told him I wanted to do a storytelling show. He had some trepidation about it, but he says, you know what? I like you. I think you know what you're doing, so try it. And we did. And this once a month show became so popular that we were given it in a weekly spot. We were given 6 a.m. on a Monday morning first. That was tough because I had to buy donuts for everybody. And then we went from Monday morning to Thursday at 10 p.m. Warren, you remember that? That's when you guys came alone. And and now that we're all extraordinarily old, we can't be up that late. No, but in any event, more importantly, they gave us this prime 8 o'clock spot on Wednesday where Mary, Greg, Warren, yourself, and myself, and two magnificent, resourceful people, Nicole and Tatiana, have put together, I think, something so real and so wonderful that we need to make sure that we keep it alive in the community forever. The history of the show is a remarkable thing, just as our guests week in and week out. So we really do need everyone to call, please, or to get online, kpft.org, go to donations, tell us how you want to pay, and then scroll, please. So What's Your Story is a show that you designate as your favorite. You can get online. You can be out of line. You can be in a lineup. We don't care. We just want you to get online, get on the phone, and please let us know that you support live storytelling in Houston, Texas. Please. We do want to thank our very special sponsor, the Houston Storyteller Guild, for a very nice donation, very generous donation, as well as Ruth Wentz, a wonderful friend of the show, whose husband Jason is going to be on next week. And again, please give us a call at 713-526-5738. Warren, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Hank. And Tatiana's got an announcement from our storytelling calendar.
Well, Warren, the Houston Storytellers Guild meets the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. That's next week, July 24th. You can come and just enjoy the stories, or you can tell one of your own. And next Wednesday, Hank will host Jason Wentz, Carla Iglesias for a summer mix special. It's the last week for our KPFT fund. So if you don't call tonight, please, please, please be sure to call Hank next Wednesday between 8 and 9 p.m. with your donations. All of us at So What's Your Story love all of you, and we are forever grateful to you for your tireless support.
Thank you, Tatiana. Well, back to storytelling. My guests tonight are Michelle Schmidt and Ricardo Nuila. Michelle kicked off the show with a story about a somewhat typical day in the emergency room. And Ricardo told a couple of stories that were supposedly about about natural deaths, but there was a little bit of irony there. And Michelle, I think we've got time for one more story.
Fantastic.
Great.
So this next story I'm going to read is called Laura and the Flood. And the story is a little bit personal because it's about my cousin. Mm-hmm. So grief can come at you like a flood. It can be sudden and catastrophic, like our city after Hurricane Harvey. Or it can be slow and insidious, with the water slowly rising. You don't realize you're drowning till your head is almost completely underwater. On August 26, 2017, Houston flooded. And on August 30, 2017, my cousin Laura died unexpectedly, one day shy of her 49th birthday. Losing her in the midst of a natural disaster has caused me more personal damage than the actual storm. At the time of Laura's death, I tried to shelve my sadness, but the loss kept seeping in over the floorboards and through the cracks in the walls. Before I knew it, I was completely underwater and I couldn't see the surface. Throughout the hurricane, our house had remained a dry and electrically intact island, and once the water receded, I felt the need to atone for my fortune. I was eager to rip out sheetrock, work in the temporary clinic at the convention center, or help colleagues find housing. I had recruited my entire family to do good deeds. But on the morning of August 30th, I could not have anticipated how my life was about to change. I stepped out of the shower, and with my towel still wrapped around me, my husband delivered the following news. My cousin Laura had collapsed and died about 2 hours earlier. His words thudded onto the floor in front of me, and I plowed through them. Harvey's destruction surrounded me, and I could not hear that Laura was suddenly gone. From our very existence 49 years ago, Laura and I had been thrown together. 2 months after my birth, my mom and I were sent to live in San Francisco with her older brother and his wife and their 3-month-old baby, Laura. No one else wanted us, an unwed teen mother and her illegitimate child. My aunt and uncle opened their home, and Laura and I were forever bound in a type of closeness that transcended our understanding. I knew her, and she knew me. Our relationship was held together with a lifetime of memories. She was my person. Because of raising kids, work, and other responsibilities, we put off the trip that she and I had been promising ourselves for the past 20 years. In May of 2017, for Mother's Day, we finally did it. We went to the beach for 6 days with her sister and our mothers. Without internet connection, we talked, laughed, and played games. Little did we know it would be our first ever and last ever annual trip to Florida. On the day Laura died, I had volunteered to care for the baby of an ER resident who lost her home. While her laundry spun in my washer and dryer, I processed what my husband had just told me. Inconceivably, I thought to myself that Laura had chosen an inconvenient time to die. At that precise moment, I resented her. The hurricane had been dramatic enough, with its 13 trillion gallons of water and its decimation of lives. Being trapped in my house for 4 days with the constant newsreel of devastation had a huge impact. My only way to work through this trauma was to participate in the relief efforts, and Laura's death interfered with that. How was I supposed to grieve for Houston and face the larger, more personal crisis of losing my cousin, the sister I never had? What happened next is similar to the times I've forgotten to turn off the water when we fill our pool. The water overflows into the street, and our water bill reflects the oversight. That morning, August 30th, I turned on a faucet in my mind and walked away. The consequences were bad. I could see the damage caused by my flooded mind, but I couldn't stop the water from rising. In the days that followed the hurricane, before Laura's funeral, I had two tasks: to process the loss that had affected Houston and to grieve my cousin's death. In retrospect, my only job should have been to mourn for my cousin. But the aftermath of the hurricane could not be ignored. While I systematically filed through every photo album, box, and electronic file of photos, attempting to create our entire existence together, I baked 20 dozen Nestle Toll House cookies and delivered them to fire stations. All night, I poured through thousands of photographs, and all day, to the extent that my mind would allow me, I'd give half-hearted attempts to help those in need. I couldn't see it, but I was the one who needed help. During this time, I didn't shed a single tear. I was too busy with my tubes of mass-produced cookie dough and anonymous firemen and photo-documenting memories as I ignored my husband and my children. After the funeral, I started to get physical manifestations of my unprocessed sadness. First, my head itched like crazy. For a solid 2 weeks, I just kept scratching my scalp like a dog with fleas. I could not concentrate. In clinic, I listened as an intern presented a patient to me. He mentioned a drug routinely used in asthma, and I argued about its appropriateness. Finally, he pulled out his smartphone and showed me I was wrong. I barely had the mental capacity to brush my teeth, and I had the responsibility of teaching medicine residents and treating sick patients. At home, I became more compulsive in my actions, to the neglect of cooking, cleaning, and caring for my children. For the past decade, a dozen balls of fuzzy yarn had sat intertwined at the bottom of my closet, and every night I sat on the sofa and unraveled the yarn. It was as though once I untangled the yarn, I'd have untangled the mess in my head. Because of the flood, my children started school 2 weeks late, and during that time, I didn't know where they were, what they ate, or when they went to sleep. One Friday night, after I had freed about 2 balls of yarn, I realized I had no idea the whereabouts of my 13-year-old daughter. I asked her 16-year-old brother to track her down. It was my job to look after my daughter, not my son's, but I couldn't get off the sofa. She and a friend were watching a scary movie at a boy's house. My son assumed the role of the parent that night and knocked on the door, introduced himself to the parents, retrieved his sister, and brought her home. In the recesses of my mind, I knew that it was my job, but I didn't care. I also knew that my 13-year-old daughter shouldn't be at the home of some random boy at 10:30 on a Friday night, but it was too much to be present and involved. I did finally unravel all of the yarn. The colors are bright and beautiful, and the textures are varied. I bought a glass apothecary's jar in which to display them. Lara was always that ray of sunshine in my life, and I decorated my den with colors as bold and warm and radiant as her personality. A friend and I went for coffee, and she told me to forgive myself for retroactively parenting. She also gave me a hall pass to extend some grace to myself. She suggested we start a walk-jog program, not actually running together, but accountable to each other. Initially, I'd walk for 2 minutes, then jog for 1 minute, and I'd do this for 30 minutes, barely breathing the entire time. It was only our promises of shaming each other and the last vestiges of sheer will that got me out that door. As the ratio flipped and I started jogging for longer intervals of time, the cloud started to lift from my field of vision. By the time I was jogging for 15 consecutive minutes, I could see the sun beginning to shine. It's like the further and faster I ran, the closer I could get to heaven. My story with Lara has been like a book or a movie that ends too soon. I wish the audience could choose an alternate ending. My mom goes to a church whose pastor lost his wife of 54 years recently. In his first sermon, after her death, he told his congregation that he'd retreated to an island for several months. When my mom told me this, I cried, because that's where I've been, on my own island, not working and concentrating on myself. After the hurricane and upon her death, my world literally and figuratively flooded. Slowly, I started to tread water till I could get to my island. Just like the days following the hurricane, the flood water surrounding me eventually receded. The grief is still with me, and I know it will never leave, but maybe one day it will be more familiar. Sometimes I still shake my fist at God, wondering how He allows people like my cousin Lara to die. But I'm no longer drowning right now, and I'm still standing on dry ground.
Thank you for sharing that story. If I may ask, you said you did not shed a tear. Did the tears ever come?
Yes. They still do at random times.
Right. Do you think your difficulty shedding a tear had to do with your personality or your professional persona or...
I think because of what Ricardo and I do, we compartmentalize things, and so it bleeds over sometimes into your personal life. And so I couldn't deal with my cousin Laura's death, so I compartmentalized it and put it on a shelf, but it wasn't really very healthy.
Right. I applaud you for that insight. I think, you know, from Ricardo's stories, it's very clear that you all really do deal with death and with the really painful and traumatic things professionally, and you do have to put up some walls sometimes just to get through the day. And but then when you have a personal experience of death, it doesn't really work for that.
No. Nor should it.
Yeah. Do you have any advice, either you or Ricardo, for young doctors, young nurses, how to process the pain?
I think we'd both say to write.
Read first. Read good books. Not just not just what's in, you know, not just the medical textbooks. Uh-huh. I think a lot of I think that the instinct is there for so many students. They want to. I've had students come and ask me about this, and they have a feeling that they're going to lose something throughout their medical training. They say, "I want to be a good, you know, doctor who cares about people. What do you suggest?" And so I think that they have a sense that something happens along the way. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm a believer that college gives us the tools to self-learn for the rest of our lives. So I mean, what I often recommend is just read really good books, because great writers put lives of people into those words, and you have insight into different lives, and it changes your perspective. You know, yeah. It changes how you think of the person in front of you when you're examining or talking with that person.
Reading a novel can be good therapy.
Absolutely, I think
it gets you in touch with your emotions. And how about Michelle?
I think that I always suggest to people to journal. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing more terrifying than a blank piece of paper or a blank computer screen. But if you just start writing things down and not really paying attention to somebody might be reading it, I think it's very therapeutic. That and you make sure that you exercise and have some good relationships and perhaps a higher power as well.
Mm-hmm. You both spoke of compartmentalizing, putting up a wall kind of around yourself. And that's the professional thing that may be necessary, but doesn't help when it happens in your personal life, when you lose a cousin who's really a sister. The other thing, though, that's kind of ironic to me, but that just bled out of your story, you probably didn't even notice, but was your altruism is there on many levels. And you're so good at caring for others, but as you said, I couldn't see it, but I was the one who needed help. And I think caregivers sometimes, it's just so hard to reverse that and realize I'm the one who needs it.
Absolutely.
What would you like our listeners to take from your story?
Savor the moment. You never know what's going to be around the bend, and just live in the moment and enjoy it and the people that you're with.
And take that trip to Florida.
Yes.
Don't put it off. Gee, I'm so glad you did that. Well, Hank, are you still out there?
Yes, I am, Warren. You know, what beautiful stories, and I just want to, you know, Ricardo may know the playwright, Robert Anderson, one of my playwrights, favorite playwrights. He wrote I Never Sang for My Father. And he said that death ends a life, but it doesn't end a relationship, which we reconcile in our own mind. And I think about that when I listen to both of your beautiful, beautiful, beautiful stories. And I want to thank some people who called.
Yay.
Alan, thank you so much for your donation. Stephanie, thank you very much for your donation. You know, it only takes 90.1 seconds to give us a call at 713-526-5738. I've asked Mary Edgerton, Dr. Edgerton, to kind of chime in and give about a minute's worth of her impressions of these stories. I think her insights will really be important. Hold on.
And Mary, we do have 1 minute exactly.
Okay, I'm going to try to be short. I want to tell you that I knew about this intern. I knew people who knew him, and he was beloved. I want to tell you that my cousin's son is a tandem diver and knows about having people with him who are vulnerable where he has to save them. I live on the border. My brother has guided people and given them directions on how to make it around the checkpoints. But just briefly, I want to tell you that in a year of internal medicine, I was with a young patient who died. And we knew she was going to die. She knew she was going to die. And how do you compartmentalize that? I remember walking out. I was pregnant. And I remember walking out after she died, and I said, "Will you be the guardian angel for my baby?" Mm. I am not religious. Mm-hmm. I'm anything but. But she is the guardian angel for my baby, and that's how I remember that passing.
Wow. Yeah. I think there's moments like that when you... I think clinicians should make themselves more vulnerable to those moments at all times, and that's when you make connections with patients. You have to have skin in the game. And so when I hear you say that you said the word, you know, guardian angel, even though you're not religious, that's a vulnerability that you shared right there that I think is, I don't know, it resonates with me.
And I have to tell you, I'm a pathologist. I'm going to give you 30 more seconds. Mm-hmm. I tell people, you know, I open up people to find out why they died, but not out of just scientific curiosity. Yeah. It's to give a message back to a family. It's to give a message to a family who might be hoping to contribute to cures. It's to give a message to a family that there was no more for you to do. And it's to respect that person for the knowledge that they're giving us.
And it turns out I was wrong, because it's the fun drive. We do have an extra minute, so you did fine, Mary. In fact, in the last, we do have one more minute. I've got a question. I've got three doctors here. I have this funny sore on my toe. No, just kidding.
Take ibuprofen. No.
Just kidding. Give us your favorite author or your favorite novel or something to, or your favorite storyteller.
Well, I'm reading Exit West right now, and I absolutely love it. And I'm three books into the Elena Ferrante series, and the Neapolitan novels. I love those, so those are the ones that I strongly recommend to anybody.
Great. Okay. Michelle?
My favorite storyteller is probably David Sedaris.
Oh, yeah.
I just listened to his most recent book, Calypso, but I probably have about four or five books going at all times. I just finished Killer of the Flower Moon, and that's an amazing tale as well.
Cool. And Mary?
I was up till about 3 o'clock in the morning finishing The Poppy Wars by Rebecca Kwong. And I will say it's Harry Potter crossed with Game of Thrones.
Wow.
Set in Chinese history.
Wow.
Some great suggestions. Well, thank you, everyone. These are great suggestions. Is there one more anybody wants to throw in real quick? I'm reading a book about fells running or fell running, which is the hills of northern England. So if you want to escape to a magical place, people have been running there for 1,000 years, and it's kind of offbeat, but I like it. Well, Michelle, Schmidt, Ricardo, and Wila, you shared stories about trauma and death, grief and loss, resilience and recovery and redemption. You shared stories about families in crisis, about pulling together and being held apart, both personally and as a family and a community. Your stories touched on relationships and values and all the things that matter most. You gave a voice to the voiceless, and you opened up your heart. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
And please come back. Don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are waiting in the wings to share their cool classics. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman and the entire So What's Your Story team reminding you.